We'll hear argument first this morning in Sampson versus California. Mr. Long.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court, the search in this case was not based on individualized suspicion, and no other adequate safeguards limited the police officer's discretion to search petitioner. For this reason, the search, which would not be permitted by virtually any other state or by the federal government, was unreasonable. The Court has reaffirmed many times that the Fourth Amendment does not permit the individual officer in the field to exercise unconstrained discretion to search. The Court has said that the Fourth Amendment is primarily directed at the evil. It was primarily directed at the evil of general warrants and writs of assistance. And the evil of general warrants and writs of assistance was that they gave individual officers blanket authority to search where they pleased and placed the liberty of every man in the hands of every petty officer.
Mr. Long.
With respect to liberty, I think it's not disputed, is it, that your client could have had his parole revoked even though the search was suspicionless? So what we're talking about, the difference between revocation of parole on the one hand and a separate criminal offense. Is that right?
Well, a parolee has conditional liberty, but at the time of this search, Mr. Sampson was on parole. There was no suspicion of any wrongdoing.
But I thought that evidence seized could be introduced, could be a basis to revoke parole.
Oh, well, the Court held in the Scott case that the exclusionary rule does not apply at parole revocation hearings. So if there is an unreasonable search of a parolee that violates the Fourth Amendment, the evidence could not be admitted at a criminal trial, but it could be admitted at a parole revocation
proceeding. So the consequence here is whether he will have his parole revoked or he will have a separate criminal offense.
I understand your question. In California, Justice Ginsburg, a nonviolent drug offense, the possession of a small amount of an illegal substance, is not a basis for revocation of parole. It is not possible to revoke parole in California for this offense. So parole revocation would not have been a possibility.
Well, Justice Ginsburg, I suppose, can pursue her own line of questioning, but let me ask you this, because her question suggests this to me at least. Suppose that the parole officer said, now look, I'm going to search you. If you don't consent, then I'm going to revoke your parole.
Well, this, of course, was a police officer, not a parole officer.
My question was a parole officer, and I'll get to police officer next.
All right. I think if a parole officer said you must consent to this search, this
particular
search. And he
sees the person on the street, et cetera, et cetera.
And if you don't, I'll revoke your — I mean, consent is not in this case first. I mean, California has said, the Supreme Court has said, parole and the parole search condition is imposed as a matter of law. Your hypothetical poses a question of could there be knowing and voluntary consent to a search if the consequence of refusing is revocation of parole. I would argue in that situation that the consequences of refusal are so dire that effectively the parolee would have no real choice but to consent. So it would be, in a sense, a coerced consent.
Why are they dire? I mean, he's just back in the situation he would have been in did he not comply with the conditions of his parole. I don't see that that's dire. He has a choice. He can stay in prison
and
suffer the reduction of privacy there, which is much, much greater than being subjected to — I mean, he cannot even go to the toilet in privacy. Or he can go out on parole subject to the condition that he can be searched.
I have two answers to that, Justice Scalia. I mean, first, in California, you finish your prison sentence and then parole is a separate period that happens. The California Supreme Court said in People v. Guzman and other cases, parole is not a part of the sentence.
No, but it's also clear from the California statute that it is not a right, that it's a privilege, that you get the privilege of parole in exchange for agreeing to the conditions, one of which is that you can be searched.
Well, it's in California, every inmate gets parole. It's a matter of law. It's not a privilege. In Marcy against Brewer, the court, in other cases, the court rejected the rights privilege distinction. Anyway,
California statute says it's a privilege, doesn't it?
Section 3067. But it is also a Section 3000 of the California Penal Code says every prisoner gets parole. It is imposed on the prisoner as a matter of law.
Even if the prisoner, I thought that he can turn it down, and that some prisoners do.
Well,
if they decide that they don't want to be subjected to searches.
The California Supreme Court has held, and People v. Reyes and in other cases cited in our brief, that in California, parole is not a matter of choice. It is imposed as a matter of law.
And you mean people are put out on the street when kicking and screaming when they say, no, I want to stay in jail. I don't want to be searched. I would rather stay in jail. And they are dragged out into the street. Is that what happens?
That is what the California Supreme Court has said and what the statutes say.
I don't think so.
That the statutes say that parole is a transitional period and that every inmate should undergo a period of parole. But coming back to your earlier question, the court has said that the condition of a parolee is very different from the condition of a prisoner. The court said that in Morrissey against Brewer. And the court said in Griffin as to probationers that while the Fourth Amendment rights of probationers, and so parolees, too, we concede, are reduced. The state can go too far, and if the state exceeds the permissible limits, it's a
their
violation.
Their condition is very different in a broad range of areas. You give up First Amendment rights. For example, it's typical to have a condition of parole that you don't consort with known criminals or gang members. Often it says you must refrain from alcohol. Sometimes they say you can't go near particular places if they think that's going to tempt you to return to a life of crime. Those are all First Amendment rights that are sacrificed while you're on parole. Why is this any different?
Well, there are many rights that are sacrificed. What the court has said about the Fourth Amendment rights is because parolees have conditional liberty, they will have a reduced but not eliminated Fourth Amendment protection.
What about a drug test? What if you're convicted of a drug offense, you're on parole, and one of the conditions is every week you have to go in for a drug test? Is that acceptable?
That would be different in several respects, Mr. Chief Justice. First of all, there would not be discretion. You wouldn't have the individual officer.
But it would be a Fourth Amendment right that you would be giving up,
yes,
that you would otherwise have if you weren't on parole.
And I want to be clear, we are arguing there's a broad spectrum of searches that states can undertake of parolees, and I'm by no means arguing today that all of them or even most of them are unconstitutional.
What would you say about a condition that you must, not a regular drug test, you just have to submit yourself to a drug test whenever a police officer asks you to?
Well, you know, that would be much narrower because it would simply be a drug test. I think it would have the problems of the officer would have complete discretion. If it were like the California
test. No, but I mean, the point.
Do you think it would be valid? That's what I was asking you.
I think because that's a much narrower test that could pass muster. But I would think there really ought to be some guidance to the officer. I think our ultimate submission today is this is so.
A burglar could be searched for burglar tools.
Well,
not for drugs, and the drug addict can be searched for drugs and not burglar tools.
If it were tied to the crime that the parolee has committed, you know that would give it some limitation. This is a completely unlimited search for anything, any crime.
But Justice Stevens' question highlights the point that you criticize about the randomness of it is often a critical element. I suppose it makes much more sense to say you're subject to a random drug test than you have to come in at a scheduled time when you presumably you could refrain from using drugs prior to the test. And to some extent, it's the same even if you're not talking about a drug test.
Search
is only going to be effective if it's not announced.
Well, and in this court's suspicionless search cases, you can have a random test where you draw names at random. There's some other process that doesn't leave it up to each individual officer to decide who gets the drug test or which car to stop to check the driver's license and registration. What the court has consistently held is really at the core of the Fourth Amendment is this notion of the individual officer in the field has complete discretion to decide, do I search this person, do I not? What's the scope of the search? What do
I
search for?
Are you relying on the difference between, you said, officer in the field? Would this be okay if it had been his parole officer?
Well, I
parole
think
parole officer was walking along the street, saw this guy, and said, "I'm going to search you."
I think it's a very different set of circumstances if we have a parole officer. This court has said at least twice in Griffin and in Scott that a parole officer has a different function. They are not in an adversarial or a purely adversarial relationship. They often think of the parolee or the probationer as a client. They're trying to see that the person succeeds. In some sense, the parole officer fails when the parolee goes back to prison. The parole officer can act on their entire knowledge and experience with the client or the parolee. So all of that makes a difference, and the court has noted that several times.
When he's in prison, is there any problem about the prison guards intruding upon his privacy willy-nilly whenever they choose?
As I understand the
walking
court's
walking by his cell, which is always open, and checking in on him to see what he's doing.
As I understand the court's holding in Hudson against Palmer, the Fourth Amendment does not apply in a prison cell.
And so he's better off on parole than well, at least no worse off on parole than he would be when he was in prison.
But Your Honor, that's not the way this court has analyzed the Fourth Amendment issues. It's a different situation. It is conditional liberty. It's that sort of act of grace theory or right privilege distinction or greater power includes the lesser. All those arguments have been rejected in Morrissey against Brewer and Gagnon against Scarpelli.
What do you make of? No, please. I was going to say, what do you make of the pragmatic argument that seems to cut through all of your objections? The pragmatic argument is, both in favor of complete discretion and of suspicionless search, that the in terrorem effect of knowing that these searches can occur at any moment, in fact, discourages recidivism. What's your response?
I have a pragmatic argument, and then I have an argument just based on the Fourth Amendment. Pragmatically, no other state, as far as we can tell, and not the federal government, authorizes this kind of search, that is, blanket, suspicionless, discretionary searches by police officers.
Apart from the lack of popularity of the state's view,
well,
do we have any empirical evidence that bears on the in terrorem argument?
The empirical evidence is that all the other states don't seem to be having a harder time.
No,
with
I realize that, but beyond that, do we have any empirical evidence one way or the other?
Well, I mean, California, I think that's a pretty powerful demonstration, but we do have beyond that empirically. California was with all the other states until the People Against Reyes decision. Now they've moved to suspicionless searches. They seem to have about the same rate of recidivism as they
did before.
I take
it the answer is we don't have any empirical evidence one way or the other, apart from the fact that California stands out in its system. Is that correct?
Well, I think I'm offering you evidence that counts as empirical in my mind. Apparently,
I know it, but I've said about three times that I want to get beyond the peculiar position of California to any other empirical evidence that cuts for you or against you. And I take it there really is.
Well, we have a footnote. There is a brief submitted by a Stanford law professor, and we have at least a footnote in our brief. There is some social science research that suggests that this more intensive supervision is really not effective if you look at broad numbers. I mean, I think you will catch some additional people. I mean, it happened in this case. But if you step back and look at the overall effects, it's not particularly helpful.
Why if they're going to catch some additional people, is that not sufficient? That is, why is it unreasonable, say, not for law professors, but business school professors, management consultants, to say you have a lot of prisoners in California, hundreds of thousands, I don't know, maybe more than 100,000. And we'll tell the legislature that they can cut the terms, save money, release them early. But we want to have management checks, and the management checks are you might be searched at any time. And we catch a few, and that's helpful. Now, if a state decides that, what's unreasonable about it? They're letting people out earlier than they otherwise would.
Because
says the legislature.
Because, Justice Breyer, it has to be a balancing analysis.
What's on the other side? The other side is You'd rather not have policemen search you, but your alternative is going to be in jail.
Well, I mean, the other side is a search condition that says you can be searched at any time, any place, by any police officer for evidence of any crime is a breathtakingly broad invasion of privacy.
Of course, that's what happens when he's in prison.
Well, but he has come out of prison. The state has seen fit to release him on parole into society. He has conditional liberty.
But there is a breathtakingly high probability that he is committing a crime. The statistics cited in the government's brief say that in an April 2001 report prepared by the California Criminal Justice Statistics Center, 68% of adult parolees are returned to prison. 68%. 55% for a parole violation and 13% for the commission of a new felony offense. I mean, it seems to me a breathtaking statistic like that may call for breathtaking measures to try to police the matter closely.
It is a very serious problem. We don't want to minimize it. I mean, it is a fact that many parolees, and this is true especially in California, end up being returned for technical violations like not showing up to meetings with parole officers. Some of the offenses are not as serious as others, but it is a very serious problem. We recognize that. But what the court has said is that the gravity of the problem cannot justify any means. There has to be a balancing of the invasion of privacy against the state's need to undertake this. And coming back to my second answer to the question you asked several minutes ago, Justice Scalia, I mean, ultimately, this search is a general warrant. It's a writ of assistance. It's limited to parolees. But if the court is going to stand by what it has said in Griffin and other cases, that there parolees and probationers have some modicum of Fourth Amendment rights, reduced. We recognize that. This is the core of what the framers of the Fourth Amendment prohibited.
The California Supreme Court said that the Fourth Amendment applied to these searches, but it only protected in a limited way, along the same lines as we said in Griffin. And the standard they applied was it protected against arbitrary or harassing or capricious searches. Which
yes,
seems to go to your argument, which is centered around the unbridled discretion of the officer, and the California Supreme Court is saying it's not unbridled.
That is their answer to my argument, and I want to be very clear about arbitrary, capricious, and harassing. That's the California Supreme Court's standard. So, of course, they get to define it. And they have not defined it the way this court perhaps would define arbitrary. It's not arbitrary, capricious, or harassing if it has a permissible law enforcement purpose. So as long as the officer says, well, I don't have any reason to think there's evidence of any crime here, but that's what I'm looking for. Perhaps there's evidence of
crime.
That's enough.
But if it turns out he stops the guy every hour of the day, then he has a pretty strong case that this is for harassment and it's not for the special law enforcement need that accompanies releasing parolees.
And I take it the Fourth Amendment itself would prohibit that sort of thing, but you couldn't justify a general warrant by saying, well, yes, the officer can search anybody without any suspicion, and he can choose. But, the search can't happen too often, or it can't last too long. That would not be similarly, it would not be an answer to say, well, as long as he's looking for evidence of crime.
No, but your point was that this is the core of the Fourth Amendment, and they're taking away all of the protection and leaving it to the unbridled discretion, and it turns out to be not the case. Under the law that authorizes the procedure, the California Supreme Court interpretation is that the Fourth Amendment provides protection against harassment or arbitrary and capricious.
Well, my argument is that what is left of the Fourth Amendment under the California approach is not the core. It's the far periphery. There has never been a case, and we were able to find over 100 and perhaps over 200, it depends on how you count, of cases where parolees or probationers have said, this search was arbitrary or capricious or harassing. It is always rejected for the same reason it was in this case. The court.
So which way do you think that cuts? There's never been a case of a harassing search of a parolee. That's what — or 200 cases. And
I think it cuts in the direction that it is an empty, vacuous standard. It's a standard.
Why?
It's always —
It doesn't go to the suspicionless character of the search, but it does say it has to be reasonable in time, place, or manner.
Yes.
And maybe the officers are reasonable in time, place, or manner.
Yes. But there has never been a case in which a court has rejected a parolee search as unreasonable in time, place, or manner. And
how many times has it been challenged?
As we said, we found over 100 cases in which it's been challenged in the California courts. And, if you think about it, if the search is, say, at night, the argument is going to be, well, if we said we're never going to search you at night, then you would commit crimes at night. We had a very extreme case in our brief about body cavity searches. And they said, well, the suggestion was, of course, that would be too extreme. But you could see an argument if parolees and probationers knew that that was off limits, that would become
there was a case in which, without any special reason, they did cavity
search? No, let me be – I am not aware of any actual case. We posited that. We said, because you don't need to know anything about the parolee except he's on parole, and you can search for evidence of any crime. You don't need any suspicion that – so you could have somebody, a sort of white-collar – criminal, or you check someone who's written a bad check, and if you say, well, I think perhaps you're involved in drugs, maybe you're one of these balloon swallowers, you don't need any actual reason to think that's happening. You can simply say, I want to investigate that. And the way you have to investigate that by x-rays or something else quite intrusive.
California Supreme Court might well hold that it's arbitrary to conduct such an extreme search as a body cavity search. Or to search the person when he's in the men's room or something. I mean, there are a lot of limitations that the California court
could
put on it within the context of harassment or.
But our principal submission, Justice Scalia. I mean, if California said we have a terrible problem with crime in California, and therefore, we're authorizing every police officer to search every person, anytime, anywhere, for any crime. That would be, I would submit, the clearest sort of Fourth Amendment violation you could imagine. It would be a general warrant or a writ of assistance. It couldn't possibly be justified by saying, well, if it gets too extreme, if it gets into body cavity searches, we won't allow it. We are talking about parolees. Yes, their Fourth Amendment rights are reduced. Yes, we recognize that. But saying that this sort of absolutely unguided discretion, there's no
reason.
Sort of
the reason that people, I think, are saying that is because they have a lot of prisoners. They're trying to create a category of people who don't have to stay in prison, where they have no rights. And the real question is, can California, in trying to create this interim category, reduce the Fourth Amendment right in the way you describe?
Of course they
can't do it, but the justification is not that there's something bad about this particular individual or he's in some kind of limbo. The reason is that there's a policy tending towards release, which California has decided they want to introduce this as a condition. And the question is, what's unreasonable about that?
Well, what's unreasonable about it is that it goes so far in the direction of eliminating the Fourth Amendment rights of people who are not prisoners. They have conditional liberty that it is simply not consistent with the Fourth Amendment. And on the empirical side, California is an outlier. All the other states and the federal government.
May I ask you this question? Part of your appeal of your case is you talk about the corporate offender or tax dodger or something like that. It seems quite unreasonable. I agree with you. But what if you defined the class much more narrowly and limited it to people who have been convicted of violent crimes of a very serious nature and so forth, and said as to those, they can have a totally suspicionless search? Would that
be
permissible?
One of the things we wanted to make — I think there are many things that states can do. They could — certainly there's the possibility
of — Do you think they could do that?
There's the possibility of individual determinations based on the individual circumstances. If you went category
by — I wanted to see if there's a way that the class could be defined narrowly, because I want to ask the other side, if they would allow the search for any ex-felon, for example, you could divide it in a way that seemed obviously too broad. But is there a narrower class that you think would be acceptable?
I think this could be much narrower, and in my view, it would become a much closer constitutional question if it were limited to certain crimes where the legislature or the state made a finding that there's a particular need to have suspicionless.
Say you were a terrorist, for example. And it's just limited to terrorists, convicted terrorists.
Yes, perhaps convicted terrorists. That's very different from what we have here. Because
what about drug offenders, given the high rate of recidivism?
Well, I think you would have to see the facts of that case. But if they made a finding that because of the nature of drug offenses, we need suspicionless searches rather than simply reasonable suspicion, and we need police officers, not parole officers. And there could be other regulations. The federal regulations, we think, are a model, really. They have lots of limitations on discretion.
Mr. Long, is it fair to compare California to other states? The assumption would have to be that other states grant parole as liberally as California does. Maybe California has made the decision, we have too many people in prison. We're going to let a lot of them out, but we're going to keep them on a very tight leash. Why shouldn't it be able to do that, to have tighter controls, but let out many more people on parole, which is exactly what I think they're doing?
Well, and I think they can have tighter controls, Your Honor. They could make this a special condition of parole rather than a general condition.
My only point is the fact that other states aren't as tight, and it doesn't prove anything, because other states may not be trying to do the same thing, to empty their prisons.
This court has said generally that what the court has found to be reasonable for one state is reasonable for all. And when a practice is not well established, and here it's far from well established, California is virtually unique, the court has taken that into account.
Suppose he were in a halfway house, and the state says, we're creating a status. One is you're a prisoner, another is you're a halfway house, another is on your parole. But we want to subject you to suspicionless searches in all three stages, prison, halfway house, parole. Could they do it for the halfway house?
Well, they might. Halfway houses, as I understand it, Justice Ginsburg, are largely now a thing of the past. But if the idea is you would actually be in a custody situation at night, perhaps in lockdown, and then perhaps Hudson against Palmer would come into play.
This person goes out to work, comes back at the end of the day, and is checked in.
And so your hypothetical is, could there be suspicionless searches by police officers at work?
The person who is in this semi-custody state, he's going to work, and while he's at his workplace, the police officer shows up and says, I'm going to pat you down, and then I'm going to... If you have drugs.
It's a harder case. Again, our bottom line is there would need to be some limitations on that individual officer's discretion. That's the core of the Fourth Amendment. If there are no further questions, I'd like to reserve the balance of my time.
Thank you, Mr. Long. Mr. Niver, we'll hear now from you.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court, alarmed by the state rate of recidivism and revocation of the more than 100,000 parolees, California enacted a statute which authorized the search of a parolee based solely on his status as a parolee. We submit that such a search is reasonable under the Fourth Amendment. As this Court held recently in United States versus Knights, to determine the validity of a search, we balance the state's need to search against the privacy interest affected. Here, the need is overwhelming, and the privacy interest is dramatically reduced. Turning first to petitioner's expectation of privacy, it is greatly diminished. Even if it exists, it is far less than that enjoyed by the average law-abiding citizen. No one outside the confines of a prison has a lesser expectation of privacy than a parolee.
Why is that? Doesn't that kind of beg the question? I mean, if we say he's got the normal Fourth Amendment rights, the expectation of privacy analysis seems to me to be totally circular.
That's what
say he doesn't have an expectation of privacy, so it's not protected. Well, if we say he does have if we say it is protected, then he does have an expectation of privacy.
Well, this Court spoke to that in Knights and said unanimously that the in Knights it was a probation condition, but I think obviously, the same analysis applies here, that the imposition or acceptance of a search condition by a parolee or a probationer results in a severely diminished expectation of privacy enjoyed by the parolee or probationer. This Court said that unanimously in Knights.
Well, Knights involved a situation where reasonable suspicion was required, so it addressed the problem that Mr. Long has of unbridled discretion. You still had to have an articulable, reasonable suspicion with respect to the individual.
That is true, Your Honor, but the threshold question was whether he had an expectation of privacy at all, or to the extent of that expectation of privacy. And the Court in Knights, before it discussed the balance, had to identify the factors in the balance in terms of the probationer's interest in that case. By virtue of the search condition, this Court said that his interest in his expectation of privacy was severely diminished and left open.
Why was his expectation of privacy severely diminished?
Because of the probation search that was imposed upon him by virtue of the
because of the very practice that's being challenged here today. Right?
Well, yes.
Because he saw something, he signed something, said you're subject to searches. Well, that's what is at issue. It seems to me that it's, I guess I've said before, he's begging the question to say you can do this because he has a diminished expectation of privacy. How far do you push this? Can you have parolees come in and take a lie detector test every week? Do they have diminished expectation with respect to their Fifth Amendment rights?
With regard to the Fifth Amendment rights, if they are not in custody, then, or even if they are, I don't think that would necessarily any expectation of privacy would preclude the imposition of a lie detector test. No.
Was that a yes? You can have them.
Yes, Your Honor.
You can.
Yes, but in this case,
is that right? I mean, even in prison, I'm not sure you could even do that if they were still in prison. Could you subject people in prison?
Well, of course, that would not be a Fourth Amendment claim. It would be a different.
Well, the Chief Justice was trying to get out of the Fourth Amendment into the Fifth.
Mm-hmm. In terms of the lack of precedent from this Court, you know, at this point we can only speculate. But it seems to me that if a person can be required to submit to a drug test by virtue of his status as a parolee or probationer, I don't think that it is an extravagant step to say that they could be required to submit to an interview.
Would you say the same thing if the offense he'd committed was tax evasion or price fixing or speeding? Would a person on parole for any one of those offenses be subject to the same risk of suspicionless search, and would it be justified?
Suspicionless search?
Well,
where we're back up.
Applying this statute to
yes.
A price fixer, tax evader, speeder, do you think it's justified?
If he's on parole, Your Honor, if he's this applies to parolees in California who have been convicted of felonies, served time in prison, and have been
and
released
if it
on
be
parole.
Applied to the tax offender and so forth. How about just applying it to all ex-felons? Would that be permissible?
On parole or not?
No, just the very fact that they're an ex-felon. And let the person know at the time of his discharge from prison that this is one of the things that the state is going to exact from you as a punishment for your crime.
If the person is on parole,
I'm saying he's not on parole.
He's no longer on parole, then the entire balance changes. The reduction of the expectation of privacy.
I'm hypothesizing a case in which the law will destroy the expectation of privacy because it will provide that all ex-felons are subject to search. So they would know, the same as a parolee now knows, he's subject to search. Would that be valid?
My answer to that is it would not be valid, Your Honor, because a person having served his time on parole, the state's overwhelming interest in supervision has ended. The state has determined that person, having successfully completed his period of parole,
most states don't let felons vote. I mean, that's a punishment that they impose after they're out of prison.
Yes, but this is not. Yes, Your Honor, but this is really not about punishment. This is about supervision. And if a parolee has successfully completed this parole, has been discharged from parole, then the balance change.
But you're not relying on the elimination of the expectation of privacy, because under my hypothetical statute, the ex-felon would know he's subject to it. So it has to be something other than the absence of an expectation of privacy. Is that correct?
No. A person who is no longer on parole, there is no longer the overwhelming state interest in supervision. The balance changes. Our position would be that that would not be a permissible search.
It seems to me that the principal difference, Mr. Niver, is that when he's on parole, it's in lieu of being in jail. If that's not the difference, you don't persuade me. He has voluntarily accepted the parole in exchange for his getting out of jail, and he'd be in worse condition if he were in jail. That's what seems to me makes the difference.
Well, I think that's exactly right, Your Honor. The ex-parolee, no longer on parole, is no longer in custody of the California Department of Corrections. There is no longer an overwhelming need to supervise the person who, having successfully completed parole, is presumptively not the threat to society that he was when he was a parolee. The balance changes, and such a condition, that is to say, a suspicionless search of an ex-parolee, I think would offend the Fourth Amendment.
What do you achieve by this system that you have that you couldn't achieve by a system that more carefully worked out the rules and conditions of a random search? I mean, rules, so that you avoid the totally discretionary element. And if you want to have management consultants, as I was imagining, have them. They're not just going to tell you go and ask anybody to search anybody wants. They'll have a system worked out. So why not at least require you to think it through that much? And otherwise, it is unreasonable.
Well, we have disputed petitioner's position that this is a search, although suspicionless, that it is. That discretion is not circumscribed is our position. That it is because.
Well, are there manuals? Are there any? Here is the cop on the beat.
Yes.
He sees someone that he knows is a parolee. Is there any instruction that he's been given so that his discretion can be guided instead of rudderless? In practice in California.
In practice? Yep. I'm sorry, Aaron?
Yes. What is the practice?
Okay. In practice, the a parole search may not be arbitrary, capricious, or conducted solely for the purpose of harassment.
I'm asking you about what instruction, what training, if you know, are officers given, or are they given no training, just the law that says you can search any parolee?
No, they are not told that they may search any parolee, Your Honor. Rather, they are told that the search must be to rehabilitate, reform, or have some other law enforcement purpose.
Okay, the officer says, I'm searching to see whether the person has any evidence of crime on him. For example, whether he has any drugs on him. Law enforcement purpose, supervisory, I suppose. They want to know whether their parolees are committing offenses. And yet that reason would apply to everyone virtually all the time. So it doesn't seem to be a limitation at all. Am I missing something?
It does apply. It is a limitation. It is not a limitation that would protect the expectation of privacy of a non-parolee.
Well, how does the limitation work? The guy is on First Street, and an officer says, you know, I recognize this person as a parolee, and I have a law enforcement objective. Is the person committing a crime? Is the person a recidivist? Is the person violating parole? So he searches him. The person gets to Second Street. Another officer does the same thing. 3 hours later, a third officer does the same thing. In each case, it seems to me their justification would not fall afoul of the arbitrary, capricious, or harassment standard. It's not coordinated. They have both a parole and a law enforcement objective. Why is there any limitation, then, on the right to search?
If these are, as I understand Your Honor's hypothetical, three independent searches, mm-hmm. to the extent that that could happen, and I suppose it could, limitation is it be, as Your Honor states, for a valid law enforcement purpose, and it would require...
No, but get behind the rhetoric. Is there any reason my hypothetical could not, in fact, turn out to be true?
There is
no... the unlikelihood of all those police officers out there, but leaving that aside, is there any reason in the standard that my hypothetical could not be true?
Well, Your Honor, no, there is no reason. But it requires more than testimony by the officers. If the officers each testified that they conducted the search, it also requires a finding of fact by the trial court that the searches were, in fact, for a valid law enforcement
purpose. Okay. I mean, let's assume the police are telling the truth, and the judge says, sure. So there is no limitation. And it sounds to me, then, as though about the only limitation that would be enforceable would be the limitation against harassment. If one officer did it every 15 minutes to the same person, or if there were a departmental systematic policy saying, you know, get so-and-so, that I can understand as being a limitation, but I don't see any other limit.
Well, the limitation is, as Your Honor states, if it's for a valid law enforcement purpose or to promote rehabilitation or
no, I realize. Do you agree that there is not any practical limitation other than the harassment limitation?
That harassment limitation is sufficient to protect the residuum of an expectation.
Well, maybe it is, but what's the answer to my question? Is that, in practical terms, the only limitation?
It is yes, Your Honor, that is the protection.
Okay. I thought you said that maybe cavity searches would not be allowed without some special reason for them, and that wouldn't necessarily be harassment.
I think it depends on the circumstances of the search. Yeah. There's an overarching principle here under the Fourth Amendment that the search be reasonable in terms of manner and scope. Okay. That applies equally to a suspicionless search as it would to a search based on individual suspicion. To that extent, it's really not an issue that arises from the fact that this is suspicionless.
What would be arbitrary and capricious? You told us harassing would be the repeated searches by the same officer.
Or a needlessly intrusive search, as been just described, or...
Let's assume that the cavity search is demanded at the bus station, and the officer says, we know that drugs get transported by people who ingest them in the balloons, and they get on buses, and they travel back and forth from City A to City B. Any reason that would run afoul of arbitrary and capricious?
Depends on the circumstances of the search, again, Your Honor.
All I'm telling you is he's at a bus station. The facts are that a lot of people who travel on buses are drug couriers. This person is a parolee. Would that run afoul of any arbitrary and capricious limitation?
It would, for example, if it were done in public view. If the officer did,
well, sure. But the officer says, "All right, I'm taking you down to the station for a cavity search."
Again, if the officer did it under those circumstances, it's for the finder of fact to decide whether it was done for a legitimate purpose.
Well,
or
I'm asking you to be the finder of fact for me. This is the officer's explanation. This is the factual set of factual premises on which he acts. Has he violated the arbitrary and capricious limitation?
If, in fact, it was for the purpose that you state of a legitimate law enforcement purpose, and he has been removed from public view, and it's reasonable in terms of manner and intensity, then it would be permissible.
I suppose you couldn't conduct cavity searches without some special reason, even in prison. Wouldn't that be — isn't there some remnant of a Fourth Amendment right in prison that you cannot subject, the whole cell block to cavity searches?
That would depend, Your Honor, on the prison, the prison regs, the state. I can't answer that question.
Well, I thought the assumption of your answer to my question a moment ago was that there was no such limitation, so far as California is concerned.
No, there is a limitation in terms of manner and scope.
Well, sure, but the manner in this case is they take them down to the station so that they're not going through this in the middle of a crowded bus terminal. But the point of the question was, any parolee at a bus terminal could be subjected to this demand for search. And I thought your answer was, yes, he could be. And now, in response to Justice Scalia's question, you're saying, well, there may be some limitations. So which is it?
That if the search is for a valid law enforcement purpose, and it is reasonable in scope and manner, then it is a permissible parolee search in California.
Does it depend? I mean, what if he's on parole for transporting drugs in balloons from bus stations? Does that make a difference as opposed to he's on parole for tax fraud?
It certainly might, Your Honor. And again, that would be an additional bit of evidence to be presented to the suppression court to determine whether the scope of the search was reasonable.
But all this is would be on a case-by-case basis. There are no going-in guides for the officer on the street.
It's necessarily determined on any search has to be decided. The reasonableness of any search has to be decided on a case-by-case basis.
The reasonableness here would be unreasonable unless there's some checks. We're talking about suspicionless searches. And you could have checks. But what about saying, why is it reasonable to do it without any rule-based controls on the behavior of the police? That's the question.
Okay. And the answer is, in terms of the competing interests, the lowered expectations.
Well, but what interest does it serve not to have some rules, manuals, regulations that help make sure it really is random or help make sure it isn't harassing? Or help make sure that it's serving the very ends that you hope to serve with the suspicionless searches?
If a state wishes to adopt such rules, those would may comply with the Fourth Amendment. The question is not what could be done. The question is what was done. The question is whether California's rule, which permits parolee searches that with the absolute prohibition of arbitrary, capricious, and harassing suits, and which must be conducted under the Fourth Amendment, reasonable in terms of time, place, manner, and scope. The question is whether that system, the California scheme, is constitutional under the Fourth Amendment. And here the system was designed to address an overwhelming problem that this court has well defined. The over 100,000 parolees are on the street at any given time. Almost 90,000 of them will be revoked in any given period. The California parolees require intense supervision. The statute 3067 was enacted to permit that kind of intense supervision. And the protection afforded to the parolee in terms of a requirement of a proper purpose.
Thank you, Mr. Niver. Mr. Marcus.
Thank you. Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court. Concerned about the threat that parolees pose to public safety, the California legislature in 1996 authorized both police and parole officers to search them without individualized suspicion. Whether evaluated under the special needs doctrine applied in Griffin or the totality of the circumstances approach applied in Knights, the search of petitioner in this case, pursuant to his search condition, was reasonable under the Fourth Amendment.
Do we have to decide? Not the consent approach, I take it. I didn't get an opportunity to ask the counsel who argued just previously. It seemed to me that he argued consent when he answered Justice Stevens' question about the tax evader, but he argued the overwhelming practical needs when he argued the rest of the case.
And I thought I saw some tension in the argument there. And I take it the government does not embrace the consent argument?
No, we do embrace it, but we briefed.
But you just put it, number three?
Right. Well, primarily for a couple of reasons. First, Your Honor, the California Supreme Court has not had a chance to interpret 3067A, you know, after the Reyes decision. They weren't interpreting it there, and so they haven't had a chance to revisit their ruling that, as a matter of state law, it's not — there's no consent when it comes to a parolee. And that's so we thought maybe that would be a reason this court prudentially wouldn't want to reach that issue. And secondly, while the joint appendix contains a portion of the agreement that the petitioner signed, it doesn't contain the whole content of the agreement. The appellate record doesn't contain the whole content of the agreement. So we didn't.
In your view, if the consent was straightforward in the documents, would that be the strongest argument or the weakest argument?
I think
you'll win on any.
We think all three arguments are strong. I don't think one is necessarily stronger than the other. The court certainly at a minimum can look at the statutes under California law and can certainly conclude from the statutes that if an inmate doesn't sign the papers, he stays in prison until his sentence basically terminates. And then at that point, when he's released, this another provision, section 3060.5, kicks in and his parole is revoked, and he ultimately will serve his whole term of parole in prison, so that the court can see by the statutes that it is effectively a choice statutorily that someone who does not want to be on parole does not have to sign the condition and will never go on parole.
Mr. Long seemed to tell us something different about that. They must go out. He seemed to say they didn't have the choice of staying in.
Well, I think it's fairly clear, Your Honor, if you look at the appendix to the petitioner's brief, if you look at the combination of section 3067B and then which
I think he said he was unaware of anybody who was dragged out kicking and screaming.
Right. And then if you look at 3067B and then you also look at 3067A and B and then you look at section 3060.5, which provides for revocation if the inmate is or the parolee is unwilling to sign the agreement.
This is not like you sign an agreement and you can do it or you could not do it. I mean, this is a real Hobson's choice, isn't it?
Well, if you think there undoubtedly are adverse consequences to not signing the agreement.
Could you waive your Eighth Amendment rights? You know, if your parole's revoked, you're going to go back into a very cruel and unusual prison, not the one you left.
Well, I mean, I think the test would be whether it's reasonably the consent. What they're asking you to agree to is reasonably related to the purposes of punishment. And in this case, the supervision of the parolee, rehabilitation, protection of public safety. And so we think the consent argument works very well here. But if I could, I'd like to also address our arguments under the totality of the circumstances and special needs. Faced with a serious recidivism problem, California has made the reasonable judgment that subjecting parolees to suspicionless searches is necessary to protect public safety and to promote rehabilitation.
What if it's the case that this program would allow some searches that violate the Fourth Amendment, but that this particular search would not? How closely can we focus just on what happened here, or do we have to consider all the types of searches and the circumstances of searches that the California program might permit?
Well, I think typically this court applies a very sort of narrowly tailored approach to Fourth Amendment questions and focuses narrowly on the context in which the search was conducted. In this case, for example, you wouldn't have to reach the question of whether a search of a home was constitutional. The question here is whether a search of the petitioner on a public street was constitutional, and the court does typically limit its Fourth Amendment cases to the facts presented. But at the same time, in analyzing that, I think you do have to consider what the Fourth Amendment standard is, and we believe the Fourth Amendment the Fourth Amendment itself imposes restrictions on the discretion of police officers and parole officers that are meaningful. As the Reyes court said, there are restrictions on the timing, the frequency, the duration, and the oppressiveness of the search. So police officers and parole officers are on notice that courts will review suspicionless searches very carefully. They're on notice that there are limits to what they can do. And they're on notice that if a search is objective.
Supposing there were no restrictions whatsoever, but this particular search didn't seem very offensive, would you still defend it?
If there were we think there are the Fourth Amendment imposes restrictions, time, place, and manner restrictions on suspicionless searches. And so that
he's asking you, I think Justice Alito's question. Do we have to get into that? So long as this one's okay, why do we have to get into whether there might be some other ones that aren't okay?
That's correct. I think
assume California didn't say the protection against harassment and so forth. Suppose they just said carte blanche, you can search any parolee at any time, any place, and then you'd ask whether this search was reasonable.
Right, and I think in determining that, and looking at the facts of this case, you would apply a Fourth Amendment standard to determine whether this search was objectively reasonable, and you would look at factors like the time, place, frequency, and manner to determine whether the search was, in fact, reasonable.
So
and
no matter how unreasonable the California statute might be in other applications.
That's correct, and to see whether the search in this case was objectively related to the purposes of supervision, to protect public safety, and to promote rehabilitation. That we think is the test under the Fourth Amendment. And while petitioner points out that there are 100 cases out there where the standard hasn't been used to throw out a search, at the same time he hasn't pointed to any cases where a prosecution has been based on an abusive search that this standard has been too toothless to throw out. And we think that's significant, given that this type of condition has been in place for over 20 years for probationers since the Bravo decision in 1987, and the parole condition has been in place since 1996 when the legislature authorized this and made a considered decision to switch from a reasonable suspicion standard to a suspicionless standard for parolees.
Is the government of the United States somewhat behind the state of California? It's not efficient as California in supervising its parolees? Because you don't have this rule.
We don't have this program. District courts have the authority to impose a suspicionless search condition, and some have. I think the important thing to keep in mind here is that this is the court has traditionally given a lot of deference to states in dealing with convicted of felons in their criminal justice system and making sentencing determinations, reasonable sentencing determinations, as this court emphasized in the Ewing decision. And so California clearly has a big problem on their hands. The recidivism rates are demonstrated. They're in the record. California was responding to those high recidivism rates. They were also responding to some high-profile crimes involving parolees. And on top of that, we do have a brief that's submitted by 21 states who say that they do need this authority to effectively supervise parolees.
The recidivism rate gone down in the years since the Reyes decision, since this is the suspicionless search as opposed to reasonable suspicion?
Well, I'm not sure if the studies have been sort of documented up to this date, but I think it's fair to say that it would be difficult to draw conclusions from those statistics because, of course, this provision gives the California parole and police officers more authority to conduct searches, and so to the extent it's increasing the detection of crime, and so more people are actually being put back in prison on a parole violation or a criminal violation, it wouldn't necessarily mean that this isn't being successful in reducing recidivism, because there's that side to it too.
Even apart from the lack of evidence for any change since the Reyes decision, do we have any empirical evidence, perhaps involving a control group, about the likelihood of this liberal search policy in reducing recidivism?
May I answer the question? I think traditionally this court has been very deferential to state decisions on efficacy, on whether a particular program is going to be efficacious. I mean, cases like Martinez-Fuerte and the CITS decision involving checkpoints for drunk driving in the court, even with low efficacy rates and program that's showing very low efficacy rates, the court said that these are judgments that the states need to make, and they ought to be given a lot of deference, even if the numbers don't show by clear and convincing proof that the problem isn't being ameliorated.
Thank you, Mr. Marcus. Mr. Long, you have 2 minutes remaining.
In answer to Justice Alito's question, this search is unconstitutional because the officer was completely at liberty, had complete discretion to decide whether to search, and it would not be acceptable if California said you can search anybody on the street if the answer was, well, it wasn't a particularly invasive search. Granted, parolees have far less Fourth Amendment rights than others, but this is so much the core of the Fourth Amendment. This is what the framers wrote the Fourth Amendment to stop, these general warrants and writs of assistance on consent.
We normally don't look into the mind of the officer to decide whether his action was okay or not.
Well, and we're not asking you to look into the mind of the officer. It's California's system. It's quite clear. They admitted it here. Leaves it up to the officer can have any reason for doing the search. It's arbitrary in the sense this court would use, but not California. On consent, very quickly, footnote 16 of our reply brief, the California Supreme Court has said repeatedly, including very recently, since this section 3067, that parole is not a matter of consent. It is imposed on you. This is a question of state law. Perhaps this court would read the state law differently, but as the court said in Griffin, the state Supreme Court is the last word on questions of state law. As to abuses, there are a number. One that I'll just mention, the California Supreme Court has held that it's perfectly okay if the officer knows somebody in the house is on parole or probation. They can use that as a lever to go in and search to try to find evidence about somebody else who's in the house. That is permissible under the California standard. But the bottom line here is that this type of search regime is at the core of the prohibition of the Fourth Amendment. It's what the framers wrote the Fourth Amendment to prohibit. So if parolees have any Fourth Amendment rights other than, you know, an essentially useless, arbitrary, and capricious standard that's never going to work, the Fourth Amendment has to prohibit this search. There are many other things the states can do. They have many options. This is at the end point on the spectrum. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Long. Case is submitted.